Welcome to Unboxing Queer History, a podcast from Gerber Hart Library and Archives. Gerber Hart is an independent nonprofit library and archives with collections that focus on the LGBTQ history of Chicago and the Midwest. This season was made possible by a Broadening Narratives grant from the Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation and by support from listeners like you. Thank you. Today, we hear from Michaela Floto about archival silences and the importance of seeing yourself in the historical record.
So through an unlabeled red door in Chicago is a speakeasy-style lesbian bar, Dorothy. NB Night was founded, curated, and hosted by longtime employee Lou Nienberg. And earlier this year, in 2025, I got to attend a special collaboration between NB Night and the Gerber Hart Archive and Library, an archive party. The event hosts invited the community, particularly the non-binary community, to bring their ephemera and personal history to donate to the Dorothy Living Archive Project, such as photos, flyers, zines, etc. The Dorothy Living Archive Project is an active record-keeping effort to begin to fill some of the gaps in Gerber Hart's collection. This is led by Gerber Hart volunteer Caitlin Griffith.
So this is NB Night, which is a social mixer for non-binary folks at Dorothy, which is a lesbian bar. And Lou reached out to me and Jen at Gerber Hart to sort of bring in the Dorothy archival collection. So that NB Night and like the non-binary folks in Dorothy's orbit could have a footprint in the archival collection.
I was determined to interview at least one non-white attendee. I waited for nearly an hour before anyone who would fit that description would walk in. And after some waiting, Lou introduced me to their friend Lee, and Lee agreed to be interviewed. I want to give a heads up that this interview took place in the bar, so you hear a little bit of background noise.
I asked a couple of them to try, if I could try out the one pronouns with them and see if it felt good. And they were like, can y'all call me Lee and use the one pronouns for a minute and let me like try it on the size and see how it feels. And it felt so fucking good.
And like myself, Lee is also Black and non-binary.
What is your relationship to queer history? Like, I guess, how does it make you feel? When were you, do you have a certain moment you were introduced to it?
I started looking into it on my own, and then pretty quickly, like, figure things out. Mm-hmm. And I get, like, I'm not okay.
Yeah.
I get really, like, anytime, like, I speak to, like, an older queer person or read about older queer people or see, like, old photographs of, older queer couples, it feeds my soul so much. I don't even, like, and I guess it's just because, like, it's representation and it's proof that we've always existed, and
yeah.
I did not see that representation growing up at all. It's healing. It's healing. I know I can think of two, like, queer Black non-binary people or women. I can only think of two that come to mind from history. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there were a lot. Mm-hmm. I don't see them represented hardly ever. Mm-hmm. And so when I do, it's like a really emotional, like, moment for me.
Although not directly involved in queer history spaces, Lee notes that those managing the archives have a direct effect on the content of the collections.
I do think that, I mean, depending on who's, you know, running the show, I think, and depending on who they include in the process of what they're doing, that, you know, impacts if there's big gaps or not, all this other stuff, where you're just more drawn to stories than more like your story. So you're going to champion those stories more, just knee-jerk reaction.
My interview with Lee was refreshing and familiar, and Lee had voiced much of the same frustration that drove me away from academia altogether. In that moment, I began to worry about how historians would write about non-binary identities 50 years from now based on what was gathered that night if Dorothy's regular crowd was predominantly white. So my name is Akayla, I am Black, queer, and non-binary, and I'm interested in Black queer historical archiving. And last year, I started a project called the Lavender Noir Project to begin important work addressing what I observed as a lack of Black LGBTQ representation in major queer archives. In this episode, we explore the silences among the archives. Topics around LGBTQ history have become less taboo in more recent years, but despite the many strides this history has made to the mainstream periphery, it's often fallen into the same trappings as its heteronormative historical predecessors, creating a narrative that often excludes non-white, non-cisgender, and disabled individuals who have not only helped shape LGBTQ history, but U.S. history entirely. Many LGBTQ scholars maintain strong relationships with the archival institutions, and if the collections are missing key voices, so is the scholarship around it. Back in 2018, I didn't fully understand this, and that was the year I began seriously pursuing a career in queer history. I moved to San Francisco to attend a university with a reputation for hosting well-known historians and scholars in the field. I entered that program expecting open-minded LGBTQ discourse, and quickly realized that I was yet again facing micro and macroaggressions, and that they were even worse because many white people in the queer community assumed that as oppressed people, they cannot be racist. My experience navigating a predominantly white field helped me realize I wasn't going to get an entirely accurate depiction of queer history through higher education, and that the important part of that journey was to learn the methodology and skills needed to do my own digging. And when I started doing my own research, I began to see the gaps in the archives that were dedicated to LGBTQ history. Scholars work closely with libraries and archives to produce academia building our understanding of queer history. Curators searching for information and materials to borrow for exhibitions seek out major LGBTQ historical archives and collections, and it is often easier for museums to pull from their own collections for on-site exhibitions. If these gaps in non-white and non-cisgender histories exist and aren't intentionally addressed, we are left with a saturation of academia, exhibitions, and narratives, leaving a vast amount of the community out of the conversation. Here in Chicago, we have the Gerber Hart Library and Archives. The Gerber Hart Library and Archives is located on the second floor of the Howard Brown Health Center in Rogers Park. Gerber Hart is home to the largest library of gay and lesbian titles in the Midwest, and earlier this spring, I sat down with Jen Dentel to talk about their collections.
Yeah, so my name is Jen Dentel.
So Jen has been at Gerber Hart for 11 years, first as a volunteer, and then more recently as an employee.
So Gerber Hart is an LGBTQ plus library and archives. We were founded in 1981, and we focus on collecting, preserving, and making accessible the LGBTQ plus history of Chicago and the Midwest.
So you may be asking, what's in the collections?
Flyers, party invitations, like I said, stickers and things like that. There's also things like erotica. We've got calendars, so many different, periodicals, newspapers, magazines. And then in the archives itself, it's a mix of community organizations and then individuals. So it's people, I feel like I'll usually point out, larger organizations like Howard Brown Health. So we have their papers here. And then individuals, people like Miss Tilly, the Dirty Old Lady of Chicago, so a drag performer.
I then asked about the demographics of their collections.
I would say that it skews fairly cis white and male. Mm-hmm. There are definitely exceptions when it comes to certain collections, but I would say that in terms of trans collections, in terms of collections that belong to people of color, it's something that we have a lot of gaps within the collection.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question, what he feels missing in the archives. Yeah. Do you want to say any more about that?
Sure. I think that it's interesting, and it's something when you think about it, it makes a lot of sense. But just because we were created because there was a gap doesn't mean that we don't have our own gaps and issues. So I think that, there's this kind of assumption that you're creating this space for a marginalized community. But within that, there are still these same structural issues. So there's still obviously racism and transphobia, sexism, like there are all these issues that get played out. Some of these gaps, I think, is due to those structural problems, those really like nefarious problems as well. And then some of it is also, I would say, due to a lack of resources and due to the fact that I think people donate to us. Typically, collections come to us. So typically when someone donates, then they tell their friends find out about us. And I think that the same patterns of who is donating to us mm-hmm. get played out. And we need to be better about more actively reaching out to people for collections.
So if people are connected who likely share interests and identities and are telling each other about Gerber Hart, then those collections may all look a bit similar. So how is Gerberhardt addressing these gaps?
I think programming is a huge part of that, is how we can build connections with people. But I think it's one of those things where there is this kind of active negative force, but then there's also kind of a more passive, like if you kind of sit back and don't do anything, the collections and the patterns just repeat themselves. Mm-hmm. So I think things like programming, thinking about how we can partner with other organizations and have programming throughout the city where we are popping up in different locations and being able to make these partnerships.
But not all outreach is created equal, and Jen doesn't want Gerberhardt to treat a donation of a non-white collection simply as a means to an end.
Something I want to be really careful of is the idea of just reaching out to someone important in the community and saying, hey, give us your stuff, without kind of having a reason to be doing that, to show that we are treating, like, that we're trying to treat this history respectfully, that we are going out, that we are, like, partnering and supporting work that's already being done.
My conversation with Jen about Gerberhardt's collections left me wondering what other queer historical institutions' archival gaps may look like. I had the opportunity to speak separately with individuals from two long-standing historical institutions here in the United States.
So my name is Lonnie Shibuyama. I am the lead archivist here at One Archives.
My name is Lana Gross. My pronouns are she, they, and my role at GLBT Historical Society is Director of Exhibitions and Public Programs.
I was personally excited for many reasons, but mainly because both hold significant leadership positions in major LGBTQ historical organizations, and both, like myself, were non-white. I spoke with them to get a better idea about what was happening at other archives that also focus on queer history in the United States. One Archives is currently housed at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles and is the oldest and largest archive for LGBTQ+ historical materials in the United States.
Our origin story of One Archive goes back to One Incorporated, which was a Los Angeles-based homophile organization that started in 1952. Basically, at a Mattachine Society meeting in Los Angeles, the group got together and said, let's create a publication, let's try to reach people across America and talk about what we've been discussing.
The Mattachine Society was a homophile organization founded during the Cold War and Red Scare. And at the time, homosexuality was often associated with communism, making it even more difficult to be openly homosexual. This conflation became known as the Lavender Scare, and many risked their jobs, status, or worse if they were to be outed.
And so over time, they built a collection of materials, a library, and that accumulated, and it became essentially what we are today, the archives.
Despite their impact, the Mattachine Society was overwhelmingly white, cisgender, and male, and often advocated for an assimilationist approach, which consequently excluded anyone outside of that identity, especially non-cisgender communities. So I spoke with the GOPT Historical Society Museum, which is located in the historic neighborhood of the Castro in San Francisco, and was the first standing museum dedicated to LGBTQ+ history in the United States.
So the Historical Society, we're 40 years old. This year is our 40th anniversary. So it began as a kind of community-based archival project of local San Francisco gay and lesbian archivists, historians, just general folks in community, especially, you know, during the height of what, you know, the AIDS crisis, and sort of recognizing that as folks were dying, really seemed like this critical moment to be able to salvage and steward this collective history and ensure that it doesn't get lost to time.
During our separate interviews, I asked them both the same question I asked Jenna Gerberhardt about the demographics of their collections.
Something that isn't all that surprising is I think we do have an over-representation of material of specifically like gay male collections and white gay men collections. That tends to be what comes most easily, what's most readily available, what was donated most frequently.
I would say the bulk of the collection is definitely gay, cisgender, white men, middle class, you know, because the organization was founded in large part by this group of individuals who came out of the Mattachine Society. That is what the demographic of materials that we generally have a lot of, and we are generally offered in donations a lot of as well.
I have to say, I wasn't surprised at all that all three of the archives I spoke with sounded like they had similar problems. The demographics of many of these institutions were similar to the Mashin Society at their founding, and many major queer historical archives continue to employ mostly, if not all, white staff. Like Gerber Hart, One Archive and the GBT Historical Society are putting in an effort to address these silences in their collections.
A real priority of the Historical Society has been to build relationships with BIPOC communities, lesbian communities, trans communities, housing insecure communities, to ensure that those materials are also being represented in the collection and aren't being lost. So while there isn't an exact balance at the moment, I do know that that is something that we really prioritize and that we're really focused on in our current collecting practices right now.
The museum also activates its current collection to promote more inclusivity by working with independent curators and other archives. Lonnie described a similar initiative at the One Archive to revisit their collections and make them more accessible.
For example, one of the grants that we completed recently was we partnered with the Digital Transgender Archive to seek out and digitize transgender and gender nonconforming people of color content that we have in our collections. And so to digitize that, put it up on, make it available through the Digital Transgender Archive as well as our own website. And so for that, we've done a lot of digitizing of periodicals and certain early newsletters, I would say, that have that content.
Lonnie came across materials that didn't match their usual demographic.
I'm finding things that I'm kind of shocked that we have. So through that project, for example, I found a series of articles that was published in the National Insider. So not a particularly, let's say, you know, established publication, but still had a series of articles written by a Black trans woman in 1965. And so it was really a series of articles that sort of talked about her experience and her opinions. And yeah, that was kind of surprising to find in our collections.
So what jumped out to me immediately during this conversation was that often material was there, but that material wasn't being sought out or activated in exhibition spaces due to what seems to me to be a lack of interest. And this could be a symptom of historical research itself, which is, at this moment, saturated with scholars from middle to upper class backgrounds and overwhelmingly white. I was really happy to hear that this material was being discovered in collections by people like Lonnie and activated in exhibitions by people like Elena. However, I found myself frustrated by the lack of action in the past to address these gaps and the long-term consequences I saw for queer historical representation as a result. Elena, Lonnie, and Jen are only a handful of employees at these organizations, and many of them rely heavily on volunteers to stay afloat due to the lack of resources.
I think that volunteering, it's been, you know, we wouldn't exist without volunteers.
Exactly.
It's something where, you know, it's been many years of people kind of pouring a lot of effort and labor, a lot of unpaid labor, for kind of the love of the community, for the love of the collection, the mission. I think that there have been eras in our history where people, the only people that stayed and did the work were people that might not necessarily be very welcoming to other mm-hmm. people. And so I think that people were driven away. I think that there were connections that, you know, bridges that were burned because of that.
Jen's points about Gerber Hart are actually true for many historical societies and institutions.
You know, we have been almost entirely volunteer-based for a very long time. There are three of us that are full-time now, but that's more than we've ever had. I think that the volunteer-based system certainly enables people to stay that have more resources. Mm-hmm. It also enables people to stay that may not, you know, have kind of any other things going on in their lives.
I myself had been a volunteer at the GBT Historical Society for a year and a half and had noticed the stark difference between myself and other volunteers, many of whom were older, retired, white, cisgender gay men.
So I think that it definitely favors a certain type of person when you rely entirely on volunteers. Mm-hmm. So I think it's been really incredible to be able to go after, you know, grants, funding, to kind of, you know, to pay people for their work. Mm-hmm.
As I began to research other collections for this podcast, I noticed how many collections at these institutions were donated by former volunteers. This observation brought me to the conclusion that the volunteer system may have a direct impact on the demographics of the collections. I would say a positive example of the volunteer-to-collection pipeline is the story of Ira Jeffries. Jeffries was a Black lesbian playwright, actress, and journalist born in 1932. Jeffries' personal collection is split between the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture in Harlem and the Lesbian History Archive in Brooklyn. Jeffries was a volunteer at the Lesbian History Archives and intern at the Schomburg Center. Ira Jeffries' collections contains photos, manuscripts of her plays, ephemera from organizations she was a part of, such as the Bronx Lesbian United in Sisterhood, and Salsa Soul Sisters. Jeffries' photo collection, held at the Lesbian History Archives, was actually an inspiration for Chelle Dunier's 1997 film, Watermelon Woman. A fictionalized story about a young filmmaker's archival journey to piece together Black lesbian stories from the 1940s. And Jeffries herself actually starred in that film. Watermelon Woman was a huge inspiration to my own work with the Lavender Noir Project. Collections like Jeffries are unfortunately rare, yet important contributions to LGBTQ academia. But the major impact that just this one collection had is clear, and we deserve a lot more of those stories. As Jen mentioned, Gerberhardt was seeking ways to solve the lack of non-white involvement in their archive through increasing the amount of paid positions available at the library. But right now in 2025, that isn't the easiest thing.
This week, libraries across the country were told that their approved federal grants had been canceled. That's according to the American Library Association.
And Trump signed an executive order yesterday to get rid of certain ideology from the Smithsonian. The president's order focused on, quote, restoring truth and sanity to American history.
References to transgender and queer people have been removed from the Stonewall National Monument section on the National Park Service website.
While we work to figure out how to accurately include everyone's story into our understanding of history, larger institutional forces are attacking the fragile spaces we have built. As I'm recording this, it is the summer of 2025. The Trump administration was sworn in for a second time earlier this year, ramping up their fascist and authoritarian policies. This time around, organizations like the Institution of Museums and Libraries have been raided and defunded. The Trump administration continues to attack and withdraw vital public funding allocated towards LGBTQ+ organizations and other marginalized communities. As it is now, many archives, libraries, and museums are already low-staffed and rely on labor from volunteers, and reliance on that labor contributes to those disparities.
We have had federal grants in the past, and those kinds of grants have helped us make leaps and bounds in terms of making materials accessible, digitizing large quantities of material. And it's those federal grants that are typically like the biggest chunk of change. So I think we will continue to try applying for grants for those kinds of things. But with the administration as it is right now, the likelihood that we'll get it is, I would say, low.
Lonnie at One Archive isn't the only one feeling uneasy about future funding.
This administration, through these executive orders, attempting to erase queer and trans people from public life, like even just as a rhetoric, as a talking point, like that is already a threat to our existence and our ability to do our work. But then when you look at the actual material kind of consequences to that, so the loss of funding through like the NEH or through the NEA and these large kind of granting organizations, philanthropic organizations they're losing funding, or the whole agencies that are being eliminated.
Elena feels that on top of the uncertainty, it's also really hard to bear emotionally.
You know, when you're doing this work already, but then you are also a queer trans person, like there is the psychic emotional toll of that, especially looking at our history and where we've been and how many gains we've made, and to see it go so many steps backwards, and to know without a loss of hope necessarily, but knowing what an uphill battle this will be and knowing how many people will be affected. And it's hard to kind of hold all of those things at once.
Jen describes yet another barrier in this political climate.
I think that this could cause fear in terms of people being more open about their materials. There could be fear about being public with particularly your sexuality. How could this be used against me? It feels like another like lavender scare with going through.
The stakes of visibility for non-white and non-cisgender people have always been higher, and an increase to push queer people back into the private sphere will affect those communities first. Attacks on cultural institutions, such as libraries and museums, and against the queer community have left our spaces especially vulnerable. And at this point, there's really no telling how much of our history has already been lost, because no one was looking for it, and what will continue to be lost if Trump and his administration continue these attacks.
I think it's more important than ever for us to get our stories out there, because obviously they're trying to be erased in a number of other places, and so we have to continue to let the community know that you can still come to us, you can still find your information here, and we're not going to back down.
As queer people, we should be invested in our history and need to be invested in seeing ourselves in it, because seeing ourselves in the past helps us envision and shape the possibilities for our future. And for many of us, those moments of seeing someone who looks like ourselves are rare. To remedy this, diversifying queer archival collections must be a priority of those who manage them. Because even if it's queer history, we're still just learning white history. And I think we have enough of that. There are many reasons why we have painful gaps in both historical collections and academia surrounding queer history, whether it be a lack of resources, lack of outreach, unconscious bias, or any other number of systemic issues. But LGBTQ historical organizations and collections are beginning to address these gaps and aid in broadening our own understanding of our history. In the next episode, I talk about an example of a way people are adding more types of voices to the historical record. Grassroots archiving is becoming more and more common and is an amazing way to collect lesser-known histories outside of established institutions. I would like to thank Lonnie Shibuyama from One Archives, Elena Gross from the GPT Historical Society, and Jen Dentel from Gerber Hart Library and Archives for letting me interview them. I would also like to thank Lou Nienberg and Caitlin Griffith for letting me interview people at their collaborative archive party.
This episode was produced by Akela Floto and edited by Mara Laser and Anna Mason. Unboxing Queer History Season 2 is co-created by Aaron Bell and Jen Dentel. Special thanks to the Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation for providing major funding for this season and for the support of listeners like you. To learn more about how you can support the preservation of our collections and help us continue unboxing queer history, visit gerberhart.org. Next time, join us as Akela picks up where they left off and asks, what can grassroots archiving do to address these silences and gaps in the archive?